I do want to spend 10 minutes for direct questions for Richard, Suzanne, and Dan. The two questions that are asked to kind of address, oh, I'm sorry, I have questions. Rich.
Okay. Suzanne, I guess the out of kind and how you're doing that, when you say you don't have it, wetlands in some areas and you have to go out of kind, how are you, I guess, handling the transfer or the exchange of currency, in other words, the functions and the level of function from one kind of to another when you go out of kind?
Right now, we that document with the stream mitigation guidelines kind of specifies how you could translate it into stream credit if you were to do a BMP based on, and it would have to be in concert with other things and in certain types of areas, but it kind of identifies how we might do it, and we're going to package it that way. But the program in general, and some of you are familiar with this, we're looking at going to functional widgets, and we have a couple of teams of people who are trying to come up with what those are going to look like. And I think they're quite challenged by it. But what we'll begin to measure, and it's been discussed today, is functional loss and functional replacement. And so then you would begin, if you implemented a BMP, you could, you know, get the replacement of water storage, for example. And we'll measure it that way. But right now we're relying on that guidance, and we'll have to continue to develop it as we go by. And
what guidance?
The stream mitigation guidelines that were developed in North Carolina. Thank you.
It's actually almost a similar question, both to Dan and Suzanne. I'll phrase it differently. It could be the same answer to you. What we haven't talked about much is impact site assessment to determine mitigation requirements per watershed context. We spent a lot of time the last couple of days looking at how to identify restoration opportunity given multi-scales and multi-tools. This is a good place to go. But on the other side of the coin, are people using your maps, and I think you alluded to it in the second step, is how do we make looking at a site, considering watershed conditions, as it were, water's landscape condition, then make a decision on what I need in terms of mitigation requirements. So you doing that, it sounds to me, you kind of were saying, after the mitigation issue is resolved, then we come online, and it sounds like restoration, but are your maps being used to come up with mitigation requirements? What,
no,
given the watershed context, I mean,
Yeah,
and yours are. And so essentially your maps could actually be used to say, okay, given that I'm going to impact this site, I've mapped this corridor, I have a different color on it, that will influence how much mitigation is required.
Yeah, what you actually do is calculate. I'm not going to say this, I know, but you calculate mitigation debt based upon the impact, okay, right, that's occurred, and then that becomes, you can, when you go in and do apply a restoration template, it calculates in the same units what kind of integrity score increase you're getting.
And are they now using that in the LA district?
Well, they're about to, yeah.
See, this is, we haven't talked about this notion much. I think the last day or two. So I think it's,
and then it all, you know, you run the analysis again, right, and it all translates into everything. The thing is, it's connected upstream, downstream.
Right.
You restore something here, and I didn't talk about that at all, but you also can calculate indirect impacts downstream based on those changes.
So,
and then is the total mitigation burden based on the watershed or based on versus the project?
It's based upon, I mean, I don't know. That's not my question.
But I know you don't know, but I guess it's more of a rhetorical question that the mitigation burden, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be project by project, and the mitigation burden could be catchment by catchment or watershed by watershed.
Right.
Well, I think that's one of the questions that's outside of the assessment box, I think. It's a policy issue.
It's a policy issue.
So, Richard, but the issue that you said that you haven't really talked about much is regulatory requirements.
Well, yes. So Molly walks onto the site, says, okay, I'm assessing mitigation in a watershed context. I've been hearing this for 3 days. We've been talking, I mean, you know, essentially, you know, two, maybe a week, I don't know. Some amount of time. But kind of the little icon is like walking out on the site saying, is this site suitable for restoration given the watershed context? Before you even get to there, it's like I'm standing on a projected impact site and I want to make a determination of mitigation requirements. Usually we stand on the site and say, oh, this is a good, fair, poor wetland, 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1. Now I want to make that decision relative to the watershed context, and things like difficult to replace wetland issues
so
begin to roll in.
Regulatory requirements in
watershed context, which is the upfront
part. The application of the more theoretical.
Yeah.
Any other questions for the speakers? Bob.
Back to the impact assessment, you showed a bunch of arbitrary alternatives for individual indicators. Did you consider at all multiple indicators in comparing the alternatives, sort of a screening or ranking device according to how they score or rank up, or how they
composite score?
Yeah, sort of.
I'm not sure I understand.
In other words, you have three or four or five, how many indicators, and did you consider looking at them, how they score against those indicators, an alternative, compare the alternatives to multiple indicators at one time? In other words, you mean criteria decision model, something like that.
You mean criteria, not indicators? Because indicators.
Yeah. Now, how do you compare the alternatives? What you showed were how these alternatives score against these different indicators.
And those are against different criteria.
Yeah. So have you thought about putting those together? In other words, compare the alternatives, how they rank for each of the a series of indicators.
Oh, I just didn't show it.
Okay,
that's
what
I do that. Yeah. And in fact, the in that particular case, because there were so many alternatives to begin with, there was kind of an arbitrary decision made at the group that is, you know, yeah, it's like one of these meetings. You know, there's this many people here that get together and try to decide about the silly alternatives in this thing, and they just arbitrarily decided at one meeting, the only meeting I ever went to, they arbitrarily decided that there was a lot, 10 of the alternatives off the table because they were scoring very high, and you know, and it was obvious that they were. It's been used as a tool like that too.
I think that's primarily not so much a selection tool, but as a screening tool. So
it's a great screening tool.
Right.
Yeah.
Molly,
about how long did it take to do that
The alternatives analysis itself is not that big a deal. But once you have the baseline assessment done in the watershed, it's just a matter of going through it.
Because you already
had
that.
He just took out.
We already had that information.
I can send people to you.
The intensive part of it is doing the simulation, because what you have to do is go back in and, you know, basically using aerial photography, or in some cases even going in the field, is adjusting those indicator metrics that we originally scored to reflect the new condition. Okay, some of those are pretty easy, but you got to be really careful about that. And so that's time intensive. But still, even for that project, well, that one had so many alternatives, because there were 29 initial condition alternatives, and they had a wider one. You know, they had a narrow one and a wider one, and so I had to do it for two. So it was like 40, 50, 60, I don't remember. But so that took a while. But in a typical one, you could do it in several days.
If you already have them.
Yeah, you've got the baseline to have.
Any other questions? Okay. I think we should move on to the next session. I want to first just start up, trying to engage a little bit. How many people in the room have worked on developing a decision support tool? Please raise your hands. Higher. Okay, how many of the decision support tools were developed explicitly for regulatory purposes? Half hands going up. How many of those decision support tools were developed, could be adapted for regulatory purposes, even if they were developed for that purpose?
Okay. Anything you can tell.
So for the second group of hands, I think there are a lot of issues that the third group of hands could probably learn from. We wanted to give a question. We wanted to
the other question is, how many of those tools have actually been used?
Okay, how many of the tools have actually been used? Very good. How many tools have actually been used for regulatory purposes? A little bit higher. Okay, so you're not Mark Zabel. Alan? Again, higher? Someone over there had their hand raised, right? Steve? Jeff? Rich? Rich? That was Richard. Richard? Okay.
Do we have three Richards?
Yeah. Ralph and Dan? Okay. What we want to spend the next bit of time on is talking about what challenges have been encountered or what potential obstacles might arise. We're taking some of these, the restoration priorities identified by watershed-based planning tools and linking them back to the regulatory process. People don't talk really that explicitly about obstacles so much in past presentations, if there are a few. But from your personal experiences, people that whose names I just called out who have applied it in a regulatory context, were there any kind of lessons learned that some of these other tools that were developed more theoretically that people may be thinking about applying in a regulatory context could learn from?
Well, I already mentioned one, and it was the primary challenge was the initial hostility or whatever that some people may have.
To a map?
No, to a procedure or a map. It could be a map or a procedure, some underlying that map, obviously. But and so that can be a hurdle, but I think my experience has always been that if you take the time, number one, first they have to be willing to understand. And then number two, you have to be willing to explain it to them because, I mean, doesn't do much good to explain
right.
it to them.
So you also showed that one map and you said how much people, the regulators, loved it because it showed clarity for them.
I'm referring to the Transportation Corridor Authority as kind of being, being forced down their throat and being resistant, number one, and then saying, hey, we can use this to our advantage.
Any other obstacles that you were encountering?
And this goes back to building a rapid assessment method, an Oregon method that was in place for some time. There is as you're going through the process of adoption of that process, there's a lot of people who, especially regulators, who feel it will be abused, whether it's a map, whether it's a rapid assessment tool or something. And so there's a hesitancy to say, well, you're coming out with a tool, I'm not sure I like it, and I think somebody else is going to get a hold of it and abuse it. And so there is essentially an adoption process of working through a calibration process or whatever that people get used to that it is going to work and think bad things aren't going to happen. And I'm not going to usurp best professional judgment of the regulator. It doesn't whatever comes out of the answer of this, the map,
the fear of the tool
being used, right. Yeah.
Let's talk about this a little bit. A lot of it is resistance to change generally. That's
I'm
sorry, Alan, and let me get Tracy,
Deb,
Molly, and John.
My experience has been, sort of, once they got over the culture shock, the predictability was well accepted. Everybody, particularly, the regulated public, they just said, now I know how much my mitigation is going to cost before I ever even have to put a plant in. So, I think it was a big hit.
Once you got over the hump,
yeah.
So it's not dissimilar from what Dan said. It was just once you had a willing audience to listen, and then you had to be willing to explain. So it's kind of a learning curve issue.
Yeah, culture shock. What would it look like? We're going to change the way we do it. It's not going to be arbitrary. Here's a plan. You tell me with your best professional judgment that this is acceptable or not. Now you've got a matrix, and you lay it out and go, it fulfills what you're looking for. Therefore, it's going to be an acceptable plan.
Tracy?
I have a question and a comment. I think some folks are afraid that it won't be defensible, which is a very big thing in the regulatory context. And I think another thing is that we kind of traditionally want to uncouple what's proactive from what's reactive. And a lot of folks who do things that would be like, looking forward in the watershed context of coming up with this would be great. They don't want it to be coupled to the regulatory arena because it gets a different kind of scrutiny. And so I think that those are issues that I would love to hear people address because we folks who work in the regulatory side of the shop, this is an important thing to consider in coming up with a guidance that is essentially addressing a regulatory problem. So it would be great to hear about that.
Let me take the two people I have in my queue and then I'll raise that again, okay? Molly?
I think challenges are that number one, regulators have to be aware that these tools are available, and secondly, they have to be, in this case, a user-friendly format. So regulators need to be in a form that is relatively easy to use else, there has to be an effort made to make, to show how it's useful. It has to actually
be
useful, or it's in the garbage.
You got that. Okay, John, Paul.
The ones that we've experimented with, if people don't like them, maybe it's just because they don't like change. But the two objections we hear most regularly are, you don't have the science to tell us that, or it needs to be peer reviewed.
Not principal, right. Higher level.
and we just sort of sit there,
Have any people who've experienced applied their rules in a regulatory context come up against a defensibility issue?
Well, that's where you leave a standard draft.
Never.
Well, in our case, we have that's kind of always bothered my mind. Is we've never really been challenged in that respect until recently, and. The particular one we're doing right now has been one of the county that is, whose watershed we're in, has actually hired several teams of consultants to review and thoroughly dissect everything from the GIS to the spreadsheets that we use. And I mean, you can tell based upon the review they did that somebody went through and checked every damn cell in a spreadsheet. I mean, these are huge spreadsheets,
Show them enough data and they'll stop asking questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that a good or a bad
thing?
Was it your scientist?
Well, it was. I think it's a good thing. I think it's in a sense a peer review.
What did you?
Skeptics in the county, I think, or just the county didn't have their own internal people to do it.
Was it for development projects the county wanted to do?
No, it was for SAMP. But the county is involved in a lot of shit.
Okay.
Candy and Sherry?
And yeah, I'm looking at it from a different perspective. People who develop tools that are outside, not developed by the federal or state agencies. Sometimes there's tools that are developed, and then when you present them to the agencies, there's this reluctance to even consider it. Nobody's there to review or critique them. Steve and I were talking about maybe this is a certification process or some sort of review process that should be done to see whether or not these methods are
functional methods,
whether or not some of them are even acceptable to the districts. But a lot of times the door is even closed before they even will open to consideration. That's another one thing. The other thing is that once some of the tools are accepted, federal, state, or whatever, there are sometimes abuses of them or, just misapplication of them. And my fear is that sometimes the regulators or whomever's reviewing them is not sure how they should be properly used. So my concern is that perhaps they should have some training to be able to critique the proper use of them. That's the other. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if any of you have encountered that.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a big problem. Sure.
Thank you. Sherry? On the proactive side of it, it just seems to me that the very large public works projects like aviation, energy siting, transportation, all have presidential and congressional orders to streamline. They want it now, and there's public good waiting. So those are the folks that are in the door trying to take the political heat off of the resource agency, it seems, to do all the proactive modeling and finance it and do it. So I think the question would be, are the resource agencies accepting it and seeing that relationship work? Proactiveness equaling streamlining or not?
I think another challenge would be keeping any of these tools up to date. A lot of the things we've heard about are based on a given data set. And once you get there and you got this fabulous tool, and then all of a sudden all the data that it was based on are out of date.
Yeah, the ones that they use for regulatory purposes, how many years have they been bought?
Or even still.
How many years?
That's 97. I mean, it's degraded very much. The San Diego Creek is the one we did first, and honestly, I can't believe, remember if it was 2000.
2001 or 2002 that we did it, maybe 2000. But interesting story is, when we did the initial baseline assessment, I think a year or two went by, and because of that time frame and because of the rapid development in the watershed, I had to go back and relook at it. And interestingly enough, one of the canyons that I assessed, I went back to look at it, and it was, this big canyon, the entire canyon filled. It was gone. The Coyote Canyon was gone. So you have, you definitely have to update.
Yeah, that's a real.
Having been involved with these method developments, both from the federal agency side and outside the federal agency, is that it comes back to the transparency and a trust issue. Because, I mean, the federal folks at the federal agencies don't trust a method that they haven't developed. And the folks on the outside don't trust a method that the federal agency has developed.
When you develop it, you should be
Josh?
One recommendation, this was played with it in the Bay Area too, was a modeling forum created for managers to talk to modelers, modelers to talk to modelers. The general conclusion after that thing winded down was that models should be published like any other scientific method done through peer review, through the primary literature. And usually in the special context of how is the model intended to be used, or a reviewer might be asked, how could you use the model? That would help with some of the verification and some of the credentials that come along with the model. But typically, they don't often go through that level of review. And I think that's a problem. Maybe a recommendation this group wants to make.
I think another issue or a question is this: an issue at the national level, we have to be very concerned with national consistency. And a lot of what's developed is applicable in a very regional or very specific arena. And so in terms of the trust issue that you were talking, that you mentioned, again, from the national perspective, is we need to assure consistency in the regulated community. It's a big burden on all of the, regulatory agencies. I mean, it's a rightful burden, but it is a burden. So I think that I'm asking for folks who have worked with this, is that perhaps a reason why you haven't considered how the tool you're developing could be applied in a regulatory context, or is that why you haven't perhaps engaged with a regulatory program at any level to see if your tool could be applicable?
Is that an obstacle there?
Yeah, in that arena.
National consistency.
Eric?
I was just going to say, you just have to be careful about confusing consistency and rigidity, though.
Agreed.
Any
other comments? Yes.
One of the things that's always confused me, and I think John or some of the other core people can comment on this, is the level of documentation. It's been my understanding from the EPA side in 404 that as long as you can document the rationale for a decision, that's the standard to which a court would hold you.
Yeah.
Not whether you're scientifically certain as to whether or not you've gotten to the truth. So if you have a tool, if you have a decision tool that's documented and it's written down and the rationale and the steps and how you got the answer that you got, and that's well documented so that you could hand it out to anyone, then that may be the level at which you have to make sure that you reach. Versus, it's got to be documented with peer review and 20 years of data and statistical analysis and all this other stuff. And the reason I'm confused about that is because an enforcement case recently came up where I was asked to look at it from an HGM perspective and the wisdom of the attorneys, and I know that they're a lot smarter than I am, said, gee, it's great what you did, but we think it can be shot full of holes by a cadre of scientific experts if you put it out there. So don't tell anybody you did this. So you didn't hear it from me.
it's still working its way through, but I was impressed by the fact that they wanted to step away from technical information as opposed to taking a step towards more technical information. And well, I think it's because of that.
The people who've dealt with these decision portals have had to face court scrutiny.
Well, I mean, Rich, you might be able to jump in. I've spoken at length to John Mack at Ohio EPA, and John, if any of you know him, is an interesting person because John is an attorney who wrote the wetland regulations and then went back to school and became an ecologist and then developed the assessment tools to implement the regulations. But John has lots of cases where ORAM, their method, has been challenged in court. Because they make permit decisions based on it. And the message he always gives us is they validated ORAM with two different IBIs, and the fact that they have the IBI field data supporting their method has always allowed them to prevail in court, that even though it's not perfect, it's defensible.
Right. So. He also has a training aspect, too, which is a very powerful statement. A training program for the use.
Right.
That was another one-liner they used.
Well, an unintended regulatory consequence is going to be with this cumulative effect is people are going to start using it more and more in the NEPA and alternatives analysis. And what's happening is people will take any tool or model that's out there and then ask someone to use it in the NEPA context. And it's getting very, very confusing out there around the country of when do you apply some of these tools at the mitigation aspect or at the alternatives analysis aspect when you're looking at cumulative impacts, indirect impacts in ESA, NEPA, or just in the pure regulatory mitigation need.
Eric, did you have a question? Okay. Any other comments?
You're right. It would challenge and we go to court. The record that we have is the thing that the court's going to look at. But the difficulty we have is that we find either our own attorneys. Always will end up saying, well, your record isn't good enough, and that can include things like what you ran into that we don't want to get into the. We don't want to get into the science, so it's by the time you get to court, I think it's just sort of a crapshoot.
I'm not an attorney, but I understand that given a complex scientific matter, that the courts will not get the agency deference unless the agency is shown to be arbitrary.
Right.
So we can use a functional assessment as long as it's not arbitrary and capricious and say, here's a scientific format that we use. And the other side can pick their shots at it, but if it's not that, that's a pretty tough standard to show something is arbitrary and capricious. The federal or state agency would come out ahead.
That's exactly right, and I think our record in court and probably other developmental agencies is we prevail about 90% of the time just because of that. If we have good guidance and we apply it, and use the information that we have available and make sound decisions based on that, we prevail most of the time.
Yeah, when we've lost is when we haven't followed the procedures.
Exactly.
That
our experience has been similar in court where even if the data is limited, the standard seems to be would a reasonable person look at what data was available and come to this conclusion.
Is this using your tool or is it right, just normal?
Just other things non-related to this specific tool, right?
This is recorded, so it's the problem though that I don't know about states and stuff like that. The problem we've encountered in our lawsuits is that lawyers, our own lawyers in the court and lawyers in the Department of Justice are always going to try to settle first. So they're going to be looking. They're going to be looking, or your own lawyers are going to be looking at your stuff and saying, well, or the Department of Justice attorneys are going to be looking and saying, well, you know, I don't know how strong this is, so why don't we start by settling? Because generally it's cheaper to the federal government to settle.
Are there any lawyers in the room?
Well, very unique ELI events. I need to point that out.
Quite the opposite. I make great friends. But Jessica, you could probably go downstairs and get some. I know.
Any other comments? The point we wanted to try and discuss here is just the potential use of these watershed-based planning tools and resources in regulatory contexts. And the question, the way we posed it, was what challenges have you encountered or potential obstacles might arise from taking these watershed-based planning tools and making them back to the regulatory process. Is there anything you feel that we don't have up here that, no? Great, okay. Anyone want to have any other general comments? Otherwise, I'll give you like the wrap up of the day. Palmer and Tracy?
I guess there's sort of the big elephant in the room obstacle that no one mentioned, probably for here, because there really isn't an answer to it. But all of these great tools they could be very, very useful, but the obvious obstacle to us is just the time it takes to develop them and the cost. Do folks have some advice to the federal agencies on what we should think about, how we can incorporate into our guides some way of encouraging more widespread development
of new tools or application of existing tools?
Spreading application of existing tools. I mean, it sounds like there's some really neat things happening in different parts of the country. They all sound exciting, but very, very expensive. And how can we, how can the federal agencies be a catalyst for development of places?
Rich and
I think, you know, one of the, within even EPA itself, I mean, we have grant guidance. I mean, essentially it's building the capacity with the states that they, as you heard today, Arkansas, I mean, a lot of activity is happening in the states. And it's money moving from, in this particular case, EPA to the states to build the tools that are built in collaboration with the core districts. I mean, that's a kind of a model that at least I've been working with in the grant guidance, you know, going out to the 104 grants. And again, this CRAM, California Rapid Assessment Method, tools like that, which has 1, 2, 3 components to it, that's money going to state agents, to state entities, I'm not sure what we'll call them entities, in order to get the job done. And then they reach out to the core LA district. So that's one way to build the capacity. I mean, that's how Ken worked in Arkansas, was 104 grants. And then he's working with the core. John Mack did that. Money went to Ohio EPA. He's working with the core. He trains core personnel in the use of ORAM. So I think that's one implementation model that we can use and such. I mean, Florida, you know, you're using it. Went to Rhonda Evans, gave it to Connie Bursick or whoever down there. I mean, off you went. Yeah.
And one thing I would say that I think EPA has done well is that they've the technology transfer, like when we got started in California on developing CRAM, the EPA said, okay, we're going to bring some people from Ohio, and we're going to bring some people from Washington who've done this, and we're going to bring them to California and help you guys get started. And so that
so technology transfer.
Yeah.
Transfer through convening.
Yeah.
For experience transfer.
Yeah.
Just continuity. Mm-hmm. Looking for as much continuity between efforts and states as possible, but they don't talk to each other. Otherwise, we do invent our own thing.
But it's still meeting, it's encouraging.
Yeah.
Well, I was just to build on what Rich was saying, and also I think emphasizing what happened in San Francisco, and not being in a regulatory context anymore. But I think just federal, state, NGO partnership, community partnerships. I mean, in these big areas where you get a lot of buy-in with the concerns. I mean, you're talking about trying to get money to build decision support tools. I think it can happen through that way.
Josh?
Well, fundamental need, it seems to me, are these data. It wouldn't take long. Today is not the right time. But to identify the most common data elements we need, it's imaging.
Oh, we wanted to do that?
Well, I won't go through the list, but obviously we're talking about data development is one of the expensive parts of these tools. And a lot of us fall back to DOQQs because nothing else is available. Homeland Security is generating beautiful imaging most of us can't get to. LIDAR is happening across the country. Oftentimes we can't get to it. USGS is removing gauges from streams, not adding gauges to streams. So we're losing hydrological data all the time. There are very basic kinds of empirical observations that we're losing rather than gaining.
On the positive side, we've got an X-ray coming sometime.
Yeah, it could be really good. But, you know, making sure that people know what's available, how to get to it, that kind of thing is very important. But data access, data development, data access.
Is there like a model that you can think of really just providing, was this a good example that you just mentioned? Is that a federal initiative?
Well, that's one. I think, I mean, it's essentially our EPA's 104 grant program out to the states. It's a grant program, competitive grant program, where states apply for money. And one of EPA's priorities is monitoring and assessment. This is all about monitoring and assessment. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. So that's large amounts of money.
Is that what you were talking about? You said they're about to release something.
No, I was talking about NEXRAD, which is a weather precipitation data.
Becoming
available.
Yeah, so that's a partnership. And then if we can get NWI, at least in the California situation, there's a whole story with working with the National Land Inventory, which is a new arena. So we're off a little bit. We got to develop some new partnerships there. So on it goes.
Josh,
a federal agency can come in with perspective and tools and a framework, intellectual and data framework, that then allow local interest to add resolution and detail to that, and even typology if necessary. NWI gets what it needs, and the local agencies get what they need, and it's consistent across the country. NHD is another one through USGS. That's how we got 10 meter node DEMs in the Bay Area. NHD came to us and said, can you help us build a better map of watersheds and streams? And we said, sure, but you have to use our data structure. We said, sure, and now we've gotten raised money for USGS, you know, so they can incorporate our data into their system. So those kinds of partnerships are really good. I don't think it's as though local efforts are looking for free things to drop on top of them. Those are great when they happen. But it's more this ability to upload detail into a federal structure.
I think you may see that starting to happen in Puget Sound in this big initiative that several federal agencies are involved in and many, many local constituencies.
Holly, thank you for that. Molly, Eric,
I'm going to I just wanted to say that, I don't know if this goes back to the obstacle thing, but one of the things about CRAM, for example, so far, is that, it's talking about when somebody's putting together a watershed view or a concept or whatever that's supposed to feed into the regulatory process. It would be great if people would take that sometime relatively early in the development thing to a group of regulators, not just the folks like myself who are always going around in these circles and I talked to Josh a lot. Most of the other people in my district hardly even know he exists. And so I already have a different mindset than other people in regulatory, and I think it would be very useful for these developing watershed things to be brought in front of a group of regular, you know, the whole district branch or whatever, they have meetings to get feedback from the regulators in general about how this will or won't feed into their process or how it could be fixed or it could feed into the process.
Eric and Allison?
So a couple of comments. One, I mean, so Molly is right, and so like with CRAM, that's happening with Sacramento District, they're going to be, you know, sort of the district is going to be doing that, so as a whole, not just one person. So that's a good point.
Also a little far down the road.
But the thing that, building on what Josh says, I think Josh has basically hit the nail on the head that there are some sort of key data sets. And so whether it's NWI or, for example, NOAA has come in and has produced, you know, they have CCAP, which is a land cover classification that's building into the national land cover class. NOAA's also provided this IFSAR data for the West Coast, which is a high resolution DEM. So, I mean, so there's, you know, but they added this IFSAR.
what Josh said, I mean, it's that is already starting to happen. I think hopefully it will continue to grow across the country where there are these federal agencies that have these data structures where they're working with the local entities. For example, in CCAP, NOAA came in and said, we have our basic CCAP classification. We're going to use that to classify land use, but you guys can build local sort of additional categories that fit your local needs. So those, I think, will become sort of the foundation, hopefully, for a lot of these landscape-scale decision-making tools. My last comment was that just like, you know, Candy and other folks have done with sort of assessment methods, you know, at some point, I know there's been a couple of documents written sort of surveying what's out there in terms of decision support. I mean, AWRA had a whole conference on decision support for water resources planning and put out a 600-page proceedings, you know, all about decision support tools for American Water Resources Association. So, you know, that type of, I mean, you know, do we need to keep building more and more tools? Probably not. I mean, there's probably plenty of tools out there. It's just essentially getting that information compiled and made available so people can say, out of the 100 tools out there, which one works best for my needs? I'm going to use that one. So.
Thank you.
But
Allison?
I just wanted to make sure that my point is Eric's number two point was that, you know, these, in developing the screen model with the Wetland Recovery Project in SCORP, there were several needs that were identified, and the Coastal Services Center is very proud of our relationships with these organizations and the data sets that we've been able to customize to Southern California and deliver, you know, with taxpayer dollars essentially for free public distribution.
Any other comments to address Tom's question, which was what else can the federal agencies do to facilitate use of these tools?
I don't know if it directly addresses it, except an expression of consideration that should be made. I mean, here that money's been from EPA goes to different areas for developing these tools, like the ORAM and stuff like that, but. And even like Siobhan Fennessy's report that goes through methods. But if you look at it, for instance, it doesn't review, based on its criteria, it precludes the use of HGM models. You know, it kind of kicks them out. And so what I'm thinking about is that you should provide a list of what you think the procedures should do or look at and give that direction to, let's say, EPA if it's going to go further and give providing funding to local entities. Like a strong suggestion of, I don't only want it to look at index of biological integrity, but I need to address some of these other things that are over here. So, just because the money's going out there doesn't mean it's developing the tools that you would necessarily provide the complete picture and answer everything you need to be answered. That needs to be answered. You can't make that assumption. So, is that clear?
So, the EPA should provide a list of kind of considerations that should be included in the development of tools that...
Without being prescriptive about what tools.
I mean, I think it's good to give some flexibility, but at least some idea of you have in mind what needs to be looked at for your decision-making process, right?
It's all those things.
Right, but that's not, when the funding goes out to the different localities, that doesn't guarantee that those things will be, that will produce a tool that will address those things.
Bill?
Well, kind of getting back to something I mentioned before, and then nobody said anything, so I figured I was wrong, but I'll bring
it up.
Sort of as an organizing principle, I would love it if Palmer would tell me
you want headquarters?
Be careful what you ask.
Just at different scales, in considering mitigation in a watershed context to encourage whatever that red state number says, that there are different scales and there are different tools to be used, or that could be used, or that should be used. And there, perhaps as an organizing principle, you know, start kind of from that 1-2-3 level sort of organizational skill or big scale down to the small scale, and provide some guidance, like Candy said, about what should be in those, and then use some of these existing tools as examples.
Right.
or as templates, in developing that guidance to someone who, you know, just picks it up and says, well, what do I have to do? You know, or and doesn't have the insight or the experience that those of us in the room.
Both of the panel discussions we have tomorrow, the discussion that follows them is directly related to getting your feedback on what should or could be in the federal guidance. So we'll have a bunch of time tomorrow to really flesh out some of that, but I think that's a really good starting point where there's three different scales. They should be explicit about what issues should be addressed. Perhaps provide some examples of the tools that could be used and leave the rest to the local decision makers.
Yeah, and whether we go with the 1, 2, 3 sort of
scale
thing, or whether we go with something more similar to the way that geometric shape. Or whether we go with what Dan had, you know, whereas we've got a scale of effort over geographic area, it doesn't really matter, but I think it's important to get at that because, you know, we are trying to fit this into bigger areas, and yet you have a bunch of tools. You know, Synoptic shouldn't be pushed down to too low a scale. It just doesn't work. And so therefore, you know, it would be out at the end.
Okay. Any other questions? Are there issues we should raise? And then we should get to some housekeeping things.
This is a question that's kind of crazy, that's more philosophical. Now you're not picking out my sister agencies. But I do have a question because we have some instances here where some of the federal agencies are paying state or local level folks to develop a decision-making tool. But we have some pretty significant efforts going on in areas where the federal agencies have been pretty heavily involved. Ralph, I'm pointing to you, and also in the SMART program. And just in terms of larger thinking, my question is, why haven't we moved those to a more national level? You mentioned that right now, Ralph, to get to these other levels, the state's coming to you. And as you know, I've been working a lot with NWI and HD overlap for issues of that one we don't mention.
Well, but we have the SMART and...
SMART and NWI. Those are instances of things that we have that could very much start to be supportive of decision-making in a regulatory context. And my question is just to inform this. For instance, you work very much in a regulatory agency. I recognize that you're in ERDC, which is ORD branch, much like Synoptic has been developed at EPA's ORD branch. And so I'm just wondering if folks on that side of things could help inform folks in the regulatory side of the shop what we can do to help promote tools into which we've obviously put a lot of thinking and a lot of effort and are probably well on the way to being things that would be incredibly useful.
I mean, one of the biggest things for our program would be support, active, vocal support from other agencies and financial. And so whether it's from, like a lot of the projects, all of the projects that we've done in terms of any functional analysis of watershed level, have been funded by other agencies, and the money really comes through EPA in large part, either that or maybe from coastal zone management or something like that. But I mean, our own agency, we don't really do a lot of watershed planning, and given budget situations, I mean, our program, our prospects in the future don't look really good. So we need all the support from other agencies. And so even letters to say, look, this is useful information, we really need it. Because when I look at the presentations today, there's a lot of tools out there to do with, you know, this prioritization and everything else. But the bottom line is, it's all dependent on data. And that data, if it's not updated constantly, I mean, you know, how long does it take for the data to be obsolete? Well, it depends on how rapid development is. I mean, we did mapping work down in southeastern Virginia probably 3 times already, and the second time we go out, sometimes we go out in the field and we can't even find the roads, you know, that are on the ground. We can't even locate where we are because the whole area has been filled with everything else. So in certain areas, you're going to have to update periodically, and it's not in the program. You know, our program is such that we might update you know, once every 5 or 10 years or something like that for high priority areas, not the whole country. So it's a matter of just getting a lot of support from agencies, you know, in the federal government, state governments, local governments, and whoever.
Steve,
And then I'll let Molly talk. A lot of the tools in the SMART program are actually being used for TMDL assessments and watershed types of things, so maybe that's a regulatory type of approach. Very, very hooked up with basins, for instance. Most of the tools that I, on that end, I would put in a group of numerical models. Okay. On the other end, you've got HGM and HEP and all that that are being used in the regulatory mode. So what SMART's trying to do is bring that together a good bit. But our funding, there's different colors of money in the Corps, and we're not using regulatory dollars, but that doesn't mean regulatory can't use these types of tools. It's just there was a great picture of two different scenarios that the line between could be the hall between, you know, Group A could be. We're trying to break down that barrier. I mean, that to me is the investment of me being here, I think, because I come from the GI funded. And quite frankly, it's like Survivor Series. Even as we speak, the navigants and the flutters and the environmentals are now meeting to see who gets voted off the island with money. You know, my piece of the budget for environmental, whether it's regulatory or planning, is small compared to navigation and flood control, so we're in a budget fight like everybody else, but there's certainly opportunity there, and crossbreeding with EPA is going to be the way to go, and EPA and others for sure. NRCS, we're very anxiously trying to get involved with some of them as well.
Molly, and then I don't want you to start zippering too much, because I need to go over a few things before we all leave.
The important thing is that if something is clearly useful, it'll be used. I know the original set of NWI maps in our office, we ended up not really using them because we get proposals for permits. They say, we want to do this here. I think there's a wetland here. And we have to go out and delineate it, and the NWI maps weren't specific enough. And so we just didn't use it. But I think to the extent that something is, its use is clear.
It's the right cord.
It'll happen, yeah. It'll just happen.
But there's also an issue of being exposed to these different tools, which may be new to most people still.
Yes, so I don't think if you can try and convince regulators all day to use something that is nice, but doesn't directly feed into their daily work, it's just not going to happen.
Okay. Any other pressing issues? Okay.